The all-new Dukes in Soulard is the area's top sports bar. Formerly known as Shelly's, it's the same bar and original owner. Dukes is a great place to catch a game with TVs covering every angle of the bar, and the outdoor patio is one of the best in Soulard. Dukes doesn't just serve regular bar food. They offer signature dishes like their famous bacon gnocchi. Gather with friends on their New Orleans-style balcony. It's the closest you'll get to Bourbon Street in St. Louis. It's all at Dukes in Soulard, located at 2001 Menard Avenue.
Welcome back to the Ryan Kelly Morning After. Now, back to Tim, Jim, and Doug, live from the Gateway Buick GMC Studios on CBS Sports, 105.7 HD2 FM, 920 AM, and InsideSTL.com.
The undercarriage like Doug usually does, so that when Ace Atikin and mounts me on the...
Okay, that's enough.
Who was it, Tim?
Deke Dotem.
Now, Deke Dotem has already been suspended indefinitely.
It's the Ryan Kelly Morning After, CBS Sports, 105.7 HD2 FM, 920 AM, InsideSTL.com, live from the Gateway Buick GMC Studios. Tim McKernan, Jimmy the Cat Hayes, Douglas Elvin Vaughn with you on the radio program on our Lakeview Resort Captain's Log. We'll have the Lakeside Roofing Exit Poll. We'll have the Bird Early Cutlery Cuts of the Week. We'll have your emails for the email of the day, the morning after at InsideSTL.com. Two tickets to Darius Rucker at the Hollywood Casino Amphitheater a week from tonight. The prize for our email of the day. And you send your emails in, Doug, over and over again and dazzle us.
I've never sent an email into the program.
This might be your day. This might be your day, sir.
Then you could vote for yourself.
You could. Looking forward to our guest coming up here in a matter of seconds. S.E. Cup is someone you can see on CNN quite a bit and also read at various places throughout the country. And, Doug, she is kind enough to join us on this radio program today. How about that?
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Interesting to hear what she has to say.
And I'm looking forward to it. S.E. Cup is with us on the Appliances Counter phone lines. S.E., good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
We are wonderful. How in the world did you get involved with, I believe it's a gentleman by the name of Matt Jesse, who put us together to get you on this show? It seems like that shouldn't have happened, but we're grateful that it did.
Well, Matt Jesse is a friend of my husband's from the Hill, from their politics days. And he was at our wedding and, I guess thought that, you know, I might have some fun with you guys.
Nice,
so
Doug.
He was kind enough to set us up on a little morning date.
This.
Yeah, but did he tell you what this show is? Because it's really, it's not good.
Right.
It's not a good show.
He didn't lead with that, although he did say it might not be what I'm used to, but that's okay. I like trying new things.
Well, good. Well, then you've been briefed. So we're very grateful to have you on the show. I have been fascinated by your perspective for a good number of years now, and I think our audience will be as well if they aren't familiar with where you're coming from. You started off as a writer, and now have become, I think more people would associate you with television, but I think your first love is writing. Is that still the case despite your numerous television shows and appearances?
Yeah, no, that's 100% the case. I'm a writer by trade. I worked at my college newspaper and moved to the city and had a couple odd freelance writing jobs, ended up writing internally at the New York Times for about 8 years. And then during that time, I thought I wanted to write a book about politics and specifically being a young conservative in liberal Manhattan, working in liberal media, you know, coming from the places I did. And I wrote that book. It did pretty well. You know, it started getting my name out there, and that got me some TV spots. But more importantly to me, it got me a newspaper column in the New York Daily News eventually. And I've had that ever since, nationally syndicated. And I've since written another book and write all over the place. But, you know, that has also led to a career in television, which is such an honor, you know, to have a platform both for my writing and my ideas, and just, you know, to be able to turn my opinion into a career is really such a privilege.
Well, I was watching an interview in doing research for our interview that you did in 2009 on C-SPAN. It was a good interview. It was like a 55-minute interview, and I wanted to get the background in proper context and not just read it, but hear your voice and see your reaction when I asked about it, about your atheism at the time. But it was a unique way to describe your atheism, at least I thought it was, because you said you hope at some point you do become a person of faith. Now, since that interview was recorded in 2009, there's now 7 years in between, have your views changed since then?
Well, first, let me just say, Tim, Doug, or Jim, I'm not sure who this is, but let me just applaud you. I can't believe you did all that research. I mean, I've done radio call-ins to promote a book and had the host admit up front, I didn't read your book. I'm not familiar with you. I'm just really, like, incredibly impressed and honored that you took those steps. But
to answer your question,
my opinion has not changed. I am still an atheist. It's not something that I'm militant about. As I say, I don't believe in God, but I'm not mad at him. I diverge from a lot of the atheists in terms of that sort of attitude. I know a lot of people of faith. I'm incredibly admiring of people of faith. And I think when you don't have this cartoon idea of religious people, which I think a lot of secularists do, when you actually know religious people, you can't help but think, well, that sounds really nice, and wouldn't that worldview be lovely to have? So yes, I still aspire to that. I still study. I got a master's in faith studies. This is something that I've contemplated very, very rigorously. But you know, if I can't get there, I can't get there, and that's okay.
So in a sense, S.E. Cupp, our guest, in a sense, I find your viewpoint to be, first off, it mimics mine, so that's one of the reasons why I'm fascinated by it. But secondarily, similar to me, you went to a Catholic high school. Is it an all-girls Catholic high school?
Is that correct? Yes.
Okay, and I went to an all-boys.
I feel like I'm on This Is Your Life. It's amazing how much you know.
I got to come prepared, sister. I got to come prepared. So you went to an all-girls Catholic school, and then you pursued, after your career had begun to take off, a Master of Arts from NYU, as you made reference to, with a concentration on religious studies. So in a sense, It's like a paradox that you are confident and comfortable to say, I am an atheist, but you're sincerely fascinated by religion, and you don't just dismiss the idea, and you also have respect for those who are religious. I think that's rather unique.
Well, you know, I guess then that's unfortunate, but to sort of respect essentially 90% of the world, right, that believes in some kind of God, and not dismiss them all as crazy, and say, well, there's got to be something there. I mean, look, religion and God have survived, you know, Copernicus and Darwin and the Enlightenment and evolution. And, there's something about it that sticks. And so to not be curious about it, I just think is really sort of myopic. And also to not sort of appreciate that, look, there's a lot of people who find this useful. Why is that? And so I'll always be fascinated by that. Whether I become a person of faith or not, I just you can't see something so prevalent in so many societies around the world and not be a little curious about it and not have, you know, some sense of awe over it.
See, and I agree with you wholeheartedly. One of my, you know, all-time heroes, I suppose, would be Pat Tillman. And of course, you know, throughout the United States, he is respected beyond belief for what he did leaving the NFL to go serve his country. But another element of Pat Tillman was that while he was atheist, and if people remember his memorial service, his brother stood up there and said, you know, please don't say Pat's in heaven. He was an atheist. Mm-hmm. He's dead. But Pat studied religion and read the Quran, read the Bible, and wanted to know more about it, even though it wasn't for him. So therefore, there was a respect for people of faith. And I feel like that's something, and I guess I would consider myself as coming from the left, I don't know, but I feel like when many in the left talk about tolerance, that tolerance oftentimes only applies to things that they consider to be important or politically correct in 2016. And part of tolerance, even if I'm not religious, would be to be quote-unquote tolerant of those who have different beliefs than mine, if that would fall under the umbrella of religion.
Yeah, I mean, let me agree with you first by saying, yes, it seems as though, and others have said this, that the only group of people you can still make fun of in this country today are Christians, and sort of get away with it. So yes, there's a bit of a hypocrisy in the liberal, tolerant worldview that has a real intolerance for muscular Christianity. But let me also just say, secular or religious, being religious and having a position, a belief about God and religion requires a little intolerance. Now, hopefully that doesn't manifest in discrimination or bigotry, but if you're going to stand up and say, I'm a Christian, well, that means that you don't think that Jews and Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists have it right. And to stay, you know, strong on your faith and your convictions means sometimes you have to disagree with other people. That intolerance, for lack of a better word, is actually a part of faith. But you want it to be civil. You want it to be respectful. You don't want it to turn into discriminatory legislation and bigoted policies. But I do understand a Jew, for example, getting up and saying, my version of the story is right and your version is wrong. I understand that. That's part of faith. It's one of the aspects of being a believer that is not appealing to me, to be very honest. I'm not a clubby person. I'm not a joiner. I'm not an us versus them. That's never appealed to me. But that is a part of being a believer and picking a story, picking a side, picking a strain of belief and sticking to it. So I get that.
Essie Cupp is our guest on the Appliance Discounter phone lines. You can see her on CNN. You can read her throughout the country on various sites, essiecupp.com. You also said in this interview that as an atheist, you could never imagine voting for an atheist president. That was, again, 2009. Is that still your viewpoint 7 years later?
Well, gosh, I guess I'm pleased to say it is. I really have not changed my opinion on much over the years, and I don't know, maybe that's a flaw, but it's still, again, to look at 90% of the world and at, you know, conservative estimates, 80% of America, and say they're all wrong. They're all crazy. This is just delusion. They're delusional. And I'm right. I've got it figured out. I don't think that puts you in a very good position to lead a group of people with whom 80% of you see the world and life in fundamentally different terms. There's so much, despite the division of church and state, there is so much that a person's religious conviction or lack thereof would inform policy. Now, I'm not suggesting that atheists are immoral. I'm suggesting that being an atheist doesn't tell you anything about my moral convictions. Someone says I'm a Christian, you have an understanding of what their moral convictions are, even though they might not stick to them. You know what the plan is. I tell you I'm an atheist, you're not really sure what guides my moral compass. Now I happen to have the same Judeo-Christian principles as any Christian you'd meet on the street, but I don't know that that's the case of every secularist, and I'd want to know. But more importantly, I believe that religion acts as a check on the ego. And in a position of such power, I think that that person needs to put his or her head on the pillow at night and have a higher check than just feeling like, well, I'm the decider and it rests with me. I want some accountability. And there are lots of accountability mechanisms put in place, separation of powers, Congress, the judiciary, the people, the media. But at the same time, I just feel more comfortable knowing that a president goes to bed at night wondering, was I a good person today? Did I do the right thing today? And not to say that an atheist doesn't do that, but I'm not sure that someone like me, who represents such a small percentage of people with my worldview, could really be the best advocate for 80% of the country. That just it doesn't feel natural or right.
So as a conservative, how do you feel about Donald Trump, and how do you see the election going with the presumptive nominees of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party? I think a lot of people echo that sentiment.
Look, I was a part of the 2012, autopsy, the look back at that election, and helping the party reach new voters, women, minorities, gay voters, millennials, this is something we worked really hard at, and it meant a lot to me to get our party in a place where more people felt comfortable voting for us. And that was happening in the midterms. We were doing great in off years, but we couldn't get it together for national elections. But we had really made some progress between 2012 and 2016, and we had this amazing bench of candidates that were going to come up and really give voters a great chance, a great choice. And Donald Trump just blew that all up and, you know, appealed to the exact opposite corner of the party that we were trying to reach. And I'm deeply disappointed that it has worked. And deeply disappointed that he seems to be doubling and tripling down on it when he said, you know, he was going to try to be more presidential and inclusive and unifying. So the damage that Donald Trump has done to the party is going to be long lasting. We will be dealing with this for years. The damage he's done to the country, that really remains to be seen. I mean, I can't vote for a guy who wants to bring back Operation Wetback and thought, you know, Japanese internment camps might have been an okay idea. I can't vote for that guy and then tell my son in 20 years why. So this is like a personal principled thing for me. I don't malign his supporters. I get it. But for me, this is not my party. This is not conservatism. This is not a president that I'd be proud of. And so I've kind of just shrugged through this election, hold my nose, wait to get through it, and then see what sort of mess we're left with afterwards.
So you will not vote for Trump. Does that mean you would vote for Clinton or a Libertarian candidate or just not participate?
Yeah, none of those are options, really. I can't vote for Trump. I can't vote for Hillary. I can't stay home. That just doesn't feel right. I'm looking at Gary Johnson and Bill Weld. There are a couple of disqualifiers there for me, but I'm going to give that some time. But in the end, no, I would write someone in. And I'm not sure yet who that person would be, but I've got a vote.
What are the disqualifiers for Gary Johnson? We've had a few people texting in over the course of the interview, SE, asking about your thoughts on Gary Johnson. And since you brought him up, what are the disqualifiers?
Oh, interesting. Let's look at both sides of that ticket. Let's start with Bill Weld. Bill Weld isn't much of a Republican. You know, it's how he got elected as a Republican in Massachusetts. He's had some very anti-gun views, and he's had some very, I'd say, pro-choice views. Those are two pretty important issues for any conservative I know. So that's troubling, and that he says that he and Gary Johnson can come to agreements on those issues, that makes me very nervous. Gary Johnson, on the other hand, look, I like libertarians. There's a strain in libertarian in all of us, I believe. But enacting libertarian policies is very, very difficult because they're sort of theoretical by design. They're not very practical. And so just on a practical nature, I would have very serious questions. And CNN's actually holding a libertarian town hall next week on Wednesday. Hopefully some of these questions get out. But I'd have some very serious questions about Gary Johnson's foreign policy, for example, how he plans to combat ISIS. I think withdrawing, retreating from the world is not the answer. So I would listen very carefully, but I'm a little skeptical that ticket would be one that I could feel comfortable with.
Who would have been your candidate on the Republican side of all the folks they had out there? Who were you on board with?
Well, first I was with, and by with, I was never with officially anyone, but first I was supporting Scott Walker. I thought he was great. I know him personally. He is serious. He is passionate. He is compassionate. He knows his stuff, and he's gotten elected three times in Wisconsin against, you know, pretty big odds. So I really liked him. He was very smart to get out when he did because, as we saw throughout, you know, the election, it just got worse and worse.
I thought I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say I thought the problem that the Republicans faced was just the process. That debate process where the person who had the most bluster and who could criticize and insult the other guy came across as the alpha male, and that's what put Donald Trump in the position where he is. I think they need to change the process. Would you agree with that or
well,
not?
Well, yeah. No, a lot of things happened. I mean, having 18 people in a race is going to be difficult for anyone who isn't yelling and shouting to get through it. You know, a number of people stayed in way too long and shouldn't have gotten in the first place. And, you know, that part of the process definitely benefited Donald Trump. And he made a lot of being able to win with just a plurality for a really long time. The debate structure itself, I'm not sure anyone enjoyed being, you know, one of 10 people on a stage, but I don't think it would have gotten to the tone that it did without Donald Trump. I know most of the people who were on that stage pretty well, and I don't know any one of them, including Chris Christie, who would have gone to the places they did had Donald Trump not sort of started that. So, look, you know, the here's the funny thing: a lot of the changes that the RNC made post 2012 that was supposed to make the process better, moving up the calendar, some of the rules changes, Donald Trump completely exploited those. So it's difficult to say, well, what could we do to prevent this in the future? Because, I mean, you can't always predict, and someone's always going to find a way to circumvent or manipulate the system we put in place. You just have to trust the voters. And if the voters are with Donald Trump, and again, it's only a plurality of the party that's with Donald Trump. But if the voters are with Donald Trump, then you have to ask why, and you have to sort of address that. And whose problem is that? And who, you know, what do we do about this? So we can always look back, and believe me, when it comes to this election, we will be looking back for years and years and years to explain how this happened. But at the same time, I don't think little tweaks, you know, would have prevented this outcome.
SE Cup, our guest here on the Ryan Kelly Morning After. CBS Sports, 105.7 HD2 FM, 920 AM, inside STL.com. SE, what do you expect to transpire in November?
You know, God, it's become painfully clear that prognosticating is a fool's errand in this election cycle. And anything can happen. But I've been across the country. You know, I've spent a decade meeting voters, speaking at colleges, going to churches, speaking to various Republican groups. And I can't imagine that enough Republicans are going to come out to support Donald Trump in the numbers that he would need. For example, he needs 70% of the white male vote to come out for him. That's bigger than any other Republican has ever received. I just don't think he's going to get enough of them to beat Hillary Clinton. And that is so disappointing, because Hillary Clinton is such a deeply flawed candidate. If we had had a not flawed Republican candidate, I think we'd beat her handily. But this is where we're at. And I would tend to put my money on Hillary Clinton at this point.
Well, why do you think we're at this point? You talk about the deep bench with the Republican candidates, and I don't think they showed very well. I don't blame the process, but I don't know if the candidates were as good as some Republicans felt. And we see the rise of Donald Trump, and everyone is trying to figure out what's behind it. What's your opinion?
I think a lot of things. again, being able to exploit a plurality is, you can't overstate how important that was for Donald Trump. I think that can explain a good amount of how he got this far, but it doesn't explain it all. I think one thing is that his supporters, they've always been there in some form over the course of the history of our country. Sometimes they voted for Democrats. Sometimes they voted for insurgent candidates. And obviously this year they are with the Republican nominee. But this sort of underrepresented, aggrieved, angry, this group has always been there. The difference is Donald Trump is speaking directly to them. Most candidates would sort of avoid addressing some of these people outright for fear of being painted as, say, white nationalist, bigoted, racist. He's going out of his way to speak directly to them and embrace them. And so there's that. I would also suggest that a small part of this is because of the insanity of political correctness. Now, Donald Trump says all the time, and his supporters say all the time, that all the racist and bigoted comments he makes are just, he's not politically correct. That's not true. That is not standing athwart political correctness to suggest you want to ban Muslims. That's not what that is. But when you have political correctness rise to such a crazy level over the past decade, and I have been to college campuses, I have seen it, where, you know, you have to use gender-neutral pronouns and every other word on a college campus is a microaggression. In that world in which everything is offensive, here comes Donald Trump and says, in my world, nothing's going to be offensive. I can make fun of POWs. I can make fun of disabled journalists. I can make fun of anyone, and I'm going to be defended because in my world, nothing's offensive. I think a lot of people find that refreshing. I think to a large respect, it's kind of repugnant, but I think that's the pendulum swinging back. So I think there's a lot of factors, and like I said, we're going to be studying this election for years and years and years. But, you know, I think it's a combination of a lot of different things.
SC Cup with us here on the Ryan Kelly Morning After. This is by definition a sports talk station, although the show is not really necessarily sports talk. But I also was reading that you are a huge sports fan, but I couldn't figure out which teams you are a fan of. So, SC, who are you?
I'm going to guess Mets. I'm going to guess New York.
Nah,
Mets.
She's from California. So I
thought I saw pictures of her with Mets players or something.
Interesting. I don't know.
Well, I am a Met fan.
Nice read, the cat. Nice read.
Thank you.
Yeah, you guys are amazing. I lived in New York for 15 years. So over that time became a Met fan. But it was largely like in the heyday, like the late 90s, like Robin Ventura, Edgardo Alfonso, Mikey Piazza, Ray Ordonez, like that in Heald, and, you know, those Subway Series, that time was like my big. And this last year, oh my God, what a nightmare for the Mets. So it was so cool to get us so close again. So, and then I like the Packers because they're the Packers, and I always have since I was a teenager. And I don't know if you're gonna root for a storied, you know, football team. Can't think of a better one. And then I'm a NASCAR fan. Big Tony Stewart fan. Sad to see him go, but you know, NASCAR is sort of America's sport, and I just I fell in love with it maybe eight years ago, and just haven't looked back.
You know, one thing that I noticed that I think kind of paints a picture of where we are politically, and it's a little thing, and maybe it's just me, but I notice if it's a conservative commentator like yourself, even when we tweeted out that you were going to be on the show, it has to be conservative commentator SC Cup. Where if it's a liberal commentator, they will just say commentator. I never hear liberal commentator. I always hear conservative. Like it almost has to have a red flag on it. Am I wrong about that?
Well, yes. You have to warn your listeners that they might be triggered by listening to me, because I'm sure, as you've seen, I am a very controversial person with very controversial ideas. But no, I mean that is a thing. You know, I'm reluctant to whine too much because, frankly, conservatives have a massive media platform. I always get a little concerned when conservatives complain about media bias. It is there, but look, Fox News does really, really well. Conservatives have a huge prominence on talk radio, online, in print. You know, there's really not a whole lot of room to complain. That conservative voices aren't being heard. We are. So I can put up with small injustices, like having to be identified as a conservative commentator. I am on television every day, multiple times a day. I can be read all over the place. I can't really, you know, get too nitpicky about my exposure and my platform. I am incredibly lucky.
You got a chance to show your knowledge on Jeopardy. Was that like a month ago or something like that? Was you, Chuck Todd, and Jonathan Franzen? Am I right on this?
Yes.
And you won it, correct?
It's kind of like you're a
stalker. Yeah, I was waiting for you to say that. Yeah, I was waiting for you to
say that. I got to make sure I point that out, that you won it.
I did win. It was incredibly nerve-wracking. I mean, I'm a huge Jeopardy fan. If you watch Jeopardy, you always think, well, I would do so well at this show. And I you get in there, and it's a different thing. I mean, it's, you know, the buzzer and the lights, there's a lot to, like, the mechanics are a lot to remember and keep in mind. And then your mind kind of just goes blank. You're in a huge room with a big studio audience, not to mention my episode was Power Players, you know, so people that people might have heard of. And so, you know, if you get something wrong, people on Twitter are just going to light you up forever, and you're just never going to live it down. So you're already kind of guarded and afraid of becoming like a meme, a Jeopardy meme. So it was nerve-wracking, but, you know, luckily it all worked out in the end, and I got to give some money to a great charity called No Kid Hungry.
You pretty much have to hit the buzzer before you even read the question, don't you? You just get a good category you like and just hit the buzzer as fast as you can?
No, this is the folly. Actually, there's lights on the side of the screen. You cannot hit the buzzer until that light goes off. And if you hit the buzzer before, it locks you out for like 3 seconds, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it is everything in this game. So once you get the rhythm of the buzzer, then you can get into a groove. But if you're off with that, you're screwed.
Hmm. And you had a good buzzer. You had a good buzzer technique, apparently.
I figured out the buzzer. I figured it out. But, you know, that still doesn't help you know stuff. So, buzzer, and then you got to know some stuff.
Well, had you known any better, you would have told Matt Jesse no thank you and never appeared on this radio show, but we're glad you didn't know about it, and we're very grateful for Matt putting us together and getting you on the show, Essie. It has been
Oh, not at all. This is, like, totally my pleasure. What a great way to start the morning. And really, thanks again for doing all that research. That is really, really rare these days.
Well, it's right there on Wikipedia. It's right there.
Oh, I know it's not hard, but that doesn't mean people do it.
I was sitting, it was like I said, it was a 55-minute interview, because I was truly fascinated by the conservative commentator who also, you know, calmly, confidently says, I am an atheist, but I respect people of faith, because I really believe it's not the reason for the polarization of politics in the United States at this moment, but I do believe a lack of respect for people and their different viewpoints is playing a role in a lack of civil discourse. And so I wanted to see how you got there and where you came from. Even if I disagreed with it, I still wanted to have an idea of it, because this is an interview I'd been looking forward to. So that is the reason. Unfortunately, one of my co-hosts said I'm a stalker, SE, and that I have to say that is absolutely untrue.
That was dumb.
Okay, all right. Well, if I start getting weird texts, I know where to find
him. Yeah, you'll be looking to contact Matt Jesse again. SE, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Take it easy.
All right, thank you.
SE Cup with us here on the appliance discounter phone line. So.
Never before in the history of this show has been praised for research. It's a concept that we shun usually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if I care, I'll do it. But most of the time, I don't care.
Not our strong suit.
If we were going to have an adult film star, a poker player, or a political commentator whose views, I believe, are truly arrived at upon research and logic, and I want to hear that research and logic, then I'll dig in. Otherwise, I'll sit here and read text from Timberfake. That's kind of my business model, wants to study it.
I'm on board with any commentator who disagrees, but in a respectful way, you know, as you guys were talking about religion. I just don't know where that came from, how we got to this point where, because you're on this team ideology, you have to automatically hate whatever is said on the other side. You can't get anywhere that way.
Yeah, it's an odd thing. And that's why anytime this discussion comes up on the show, and it's not regularly, although it has certainly been more common in 2016, part of that, I think, is because of the fact that we got more political than we had the previous 11 years with the Rams thing, which was a political story, the Missouri protests, a political story. I go back to Senator Jack Danforth, who is somebody, I've never talked about it publicly, but I will here. It's somebody I've gotten a chance to know. I don't know if work with would be the right way to describe it, but we had lunch last year, and then he wrote a new book that came out in October, and he had me prep him, I guess, for his interview tour for the book, and so I went to his office, and we did that, which was an incredible honor. But I had always been a fan of his, not necessarily because of political viewpoints, although there are some that I happen to share. It's more for the manner with which he carries himself and for which he decries the tone of discourse in the United States in 2016. I also think somebody who maybe, Doug, I don't know if you would go back through your Missouri U.S. senators over the last 30 or 40 years, I would think I wouldn't be saying something that would be in the wilderness to say that he would be the most respected, the most esteemed of the last 30, 40 years. I don't really even know who would be in second. And that's not a shot so much as it's a compliment to him. I mean, he was going to be the vice president in 2000. And I'd like to think the world would be a hell of a lot different place had he been.
Yeah, Eagleton was highly thought of. Yeah, Danforth I would put at the top.
And so I read his book before I got a chance to know him. This was 2006. It was Faith in Politics, and he talked about how the religious right had played a role in hijacking the Republican Party. And I happen to share that viewpoint, but I'm coming at it from the perspective of an agnostic pervert. He's coming at it from a perspective as an Episcopalian priest and also somebody who, you know, served in the U.S. Senate and in the United Nations and was the choice of the search committee for vice president on George W. Bush's ticket in 2000. That search, of course, was led by Dick Cheney, who then became the vice president. I just have a great amount of respect for him, even if I have differing views. And again, the reason is the manner with which he conducts himself and decries the discourse in 2016, 2015, 2014. It's been going on for a while. And I just think it doesn't matter who someone is. And in this weird little world of business that we're in, oftentimes the stuff plays out, it gets clicks, I understand it. There are all these little wars that go on in this odd business. But, you know, I mean, one of the most famous ones, I suppose, over the last handful of years was what happened at KFNS with Dan Marshall and the man-woman thing. And I didn't appreciate the way we were treated. I wasn't going to talk about it publicly because we had a responsibility to continue to operate the business. And in doing anything that could jeopardize the business by making a comment publicly in the newspaper on the show would put people's paychecks at risk. And so I just had to eat it, and that's the way that it went. But a year and a half after all that stuff, and we had come over here to start the radio station, he contacted me and wanted to sit down for dinner and discuss buying KFNS. And while, as you can imagine, I wasn't a fan of how that all took place, even if that were the case, it's in the best interest, the greater good, to sit down and have a conversation. And I'm always willing to do that, even if it's somebody who has said things about me that I know aren't true. I think that person knows aren't true, but they just get fired up and want to take shots. And I think, you know, applying it to a governmental standpoint, a political discourse standpoint, I think if that can take place, I think you would see more progress, or at the very least, people who have differing views, Republicans and Democrats, working together as opposed to being fearful of working together and then not getting reelected because they chose to work with somebody from the other party. And I think that plays a large role in the gridlock, the stagnant governmental process that we are experiencing right now and have experienced for the last few years.
I think that's the tail wagging the dog, though. I think what we're seeing in Congress and in Washington and the stalemate that seems to rule the day there is sort of a reflection of where we are socially in this country with so much polarization that, you know, as you said, people are fearful for getting reelected or not getting reelected. People just can't seem to come together, even a national tragedy that should put us all
within minutes. And she wrote about that, and we didn't get into it. It just wasn't the way that the interview was going. And plus, at this point, you know, it's been 5 days. I'm sure everybody has heard a billion different viewpoints. It's almost saturated, but her column this week was on within moments how pick a group, whether it be whatever side, immediately politicized it for their own particular agenda. And I didn't even know one of them that she cites, and she provides quotes, so it's not just air. And I thought yesterday's interview was air. I thought that was pretty transparent, but, you know, if people liked it, God bless them. She actually backs it up with facts and logic, which I'm a fan of, and that there were people in the LGBT movement associating what took place in Orlando with the North Carolina transgendered bathroom debate. And I'm thinking, God, how did you even get there on that? Now, if they really believe that, they really believe that. Of course, within hours, you had Donald Trump's famous tweets, you had the gun lobby, you had the anti-gun lobby, and back, and then I would watch CNN over the last few nights. And I'm surprised his bosses let him do it because it doesn't seem like it's necessarily the right strategy from a rating standpoint, but I find it to be the right strategy from a human standpoint. Anderson Cooper just focuses the vast majority of his coverage on the victims and getting to know the victims and their families and telling their stories. And he's done this with a number of these tragedies over the years, and it doesn't necessarily follow the plan of how the news covers these stories with getting the person on who says you got to restrict gun, you got to regulate gun laws, the person who says no, you don't, and then an LGBT and then an anti, and whatever the case might be. And there he is just interviewing and getting emotional, which I believe is legitimate. I don't think it's a ploy. While talking with people who are family members or friends or significant others of those who pass. And I think that humanizes it for people and takes the politics out of it. And so from that standpoint, it's refreshing as opposed to hours after 49 people are killed and numerous others are injured, that people then utilize that moment to try and help their causes. And I personally find that to be repulsive.
I saw it on Twitter, and I immediately tweeted out that, you know, people trying to distill some sort of victory for whatever their brand of ideology is. It was unsettling. Twitter's great when you can find some facts about the thing. And then someone tweeted at me, Twitter's great for getting news 3 minutes later. It's the worst when everyone starts weighing in on what the news. I just don't know how we got to this point where, if anything is going to bring us together, you know, a massive attack, a tragedy, doesn't matter what segment of our community it happened to, we're all Americans, and it seems like that's lost on a lot of people, and that's the most disappointing thing to me.
I think the national media has to take some blame for this, too. It used to be when you watched a network newscast, whatever it was, you got the sense that they were just giving you the facts. It's right down the middle. Here it is. And now all the networks seem to have some sort of political agenda. If you watch closely enough, you can usually tell what side of the fence that they're on, most of them. It's become more personality-based. Instead of here's the facts, now it's how can we get ratings, how can we draw audience by having a bigger personality.
But I feel like that's chicken and egg. It's like to blame the Republican Party for Donald Trump. He received millions of votes. So Fox News wouldn't execute the strategy if it weren't making money. So therefore, they're giving the people what they want.
And that's why Trump goes on all the networks. I've heard CNN accused of being the Trump network because they had him on quite a bit because he gets ratings.
Fox fought pretty hard against Trump in the early going with the Megyn Kelly debates and all that. They weren't on board with him at all. I think they're getting that way now because they'd rather have him than Hillary.
Just when you hear the panel shows where they scream at each other and everything, and it's usually whatever network you're looking at, it's stacked, you know, for the left or the right in one direction, and then they yell at each other for a while. I can't even watch that anymore.
Your thoughts are welcome on the SC Cup interview, what she had to say. It is, I would say, 90% positive feedback, and a number of people would say are saying that they are either liberal or lean to the left, but enjoyed the interview. Yesterday, I would say it was 50-50, and people either condemning Stacey Dash or saying she's, you know, not afraid to tell the truth is usually that line. 314-880-0808, 314-880-0808. You're also welcome to text in. It's the Appliance Discounter phone lines, 314-880-0808. Let's see, if being an agnostic pervert is wrong, I don't want to be right. Doug, that's from the Right City Lemming.
I feel that way about cargo shorts.
All right. You probably shouldn't wear cargo shorts. It's kind of a young person's clothing choice.
I got a 7-year-old.
He can wear cargo
shorts.
I'm
going to wear the cargo shorts. I'm going to put his water bottle in the big pockets and whatever stuff he needs. Cargo shorts are a staple.
Well, I'd shy away from them.
If you aren't willing to risk re-election to do the correct thing, you shouldn't hold office. That's from Bomb Pop Guy. Let's see. Great show. Great interview with SE Cup. Now, could someone please oil that effing chair? Larry at the lake.
Which one's squeaking on us? Mine's okay.
Mine's okay.
I don't hear a lot of them.
Doug, look at me. Look at me. Look
yeah,
at me.
We're
pivot.
All swiveling.
Look at me pivot.
We're all pivoting that might and
be,
swiveling.
It might have been our joints.
Is it the mic?
No, I think it's...
No.
Guys, a conversation between Biden and Danforth would be fascinating. That is from Fan of Frank.
Maybe. I don't find Joe Biden that fascinating. But,
I don't either.
But
I'm not
maybe.
A Biden guy.
Maybe.
At all.
There are plenty of people out there that I would be I would run to the ballot box to vote for them. Plenty of people. It's just we haven't been presented with those choices.
That's what when people said about the Republican candidates, and even S.E. Cupp said that, you know, with such a deep bench and so many great candidates, and I'm not saying they're not good people or not smarter than me, but they certainly didn't show well, any of them, in my opinion. And I don't blame the format.
I
agree with
I blame it completely.
You had too many people. You had too many people on the stage, so it was going to be rough anyway. But I look at a guy like Kasich, who I think a lot of people could have gotten on board with. I wanted to hear more from him. I watched his town hall, and he did show better there. I think he did it on CNN. But you have to enter the fray. I'm sorry, but when you have that many candidates, you have to enter the fray, and he did not.
Well, that's the way it's set up now, that you have to get in there and criticize.
You had too many candidates. You know, I watched, you know, the Democratic debates, too, and there were fewer people, so it still looked like a clown show to me. But it was a smaller clown show, and you didn't have to yell down people because there weren't so many people on the stage.
Well, I suspect if they'd had four or five and one of them was Donald Trump, it would have come out the same way. He still would have criticized. He'd have come up with names for people. Whether there's 15 or five, I think the outcome would have been the same.
I'm not disputing that, but I wonder if you had four legitimate candidates, if that would have played. You know, clearly Trump had the name recognition, but what he was doing played. It got traction. And I wonder if it were a smaller setting with candidates that were better prepared for what was coming down the pike, if it would have played.
Iggy says he hung out with Joe Biden in Bermuda, and he's a good dude.
Hey, Iggy. Yeah, he seems like a good dude. He seems like a nice enough guy. He just, I don't know. There's just something about him that he seems like the politician out of central casting that I'll try to say the right things. I don't really know what I'm doing. But
and I've had some dealings. I think he is the ultimate politician. I'm not saying he's a bad guy.
What dealings did you have with him?
Just dealing. I didn't want to discuss him, but I knew him a little bit when I was in Delaware.
Really? How'd you cross paths?
Well, I mean, it's a small state, so I met him a few times. I interviewed him a couple of times at sporting events. And I'm not a fan. I'm not
based on that interaction?
Yeah.
Really? That's surprising to me.
He was well known at one point when he ran for president for stealing a guy's speech from England. Remember that little flap?
Yes.
Yes, that was what ended his campaign in 1988. I believe it was him and Dukakis. And that was the end for him in 88 in the Democratic primaries.
Yeah.
Janie the Lesbian texting in. What up, Tim? This gal is fascinating, great get, and great interview. Miss your brother, Janie the Lesbian.
Not even a shout-out to Doug.
Miss your brother.
I'm popular in the lesbian community, and you know what? I love lesbians.
I think Donald Trump loves lesbians and the uneducated.
I think he called it the gays this week. Who would have thought something that's right out of the show would be used by a presidential candidate? But by God, here we are. Let's see what else we got in here. Jason Day is getting ready to tee off.
Okay. Is that exciting?
I didn't even
news?
Watch the U.S. Open yesterday.
I just saw they just a little bit of it.
It doesn't feel like it's going on. Is that because it's on Fox? I'm asking sincerely, because, I mean, obviously, it's a friend of the show, Joe Bucks.
Well, they had some weather interruptions.
Yeah, though. I know that, but, I mean, there's tournaments that deal with delays, and maybe when it's on ESPN, everybody knows where to find it, but I don't know.
Maybe there's not a big storyline this year. We're not rooting for
I'm certainly intrigued. I mean, Spieth has won since the collapse on 12 at the Masters, but I'm intrigued to see how he bounces back. McIlroy had a collapse, not a debacle hole specifically, although a definite collapse in 2011. He came back and he won the U.S. Open, so I'm intrigued to see what Spieth does. I guess the fact, but I mean, how many people know that he won in between the Masters and now? They're casual fans. So I'm intrigued to see how he bounces back from that. That's that could be an Ankiel-like moment.
He was mad yesterday, mad at the course. He hit a wedge about 115 yards and hit it about 10, 15 feet behind the flag and backed it up. And because those greens are so fast, it rolled right off the green, down a hill, and in the sand trap. He was throwing clubs.
Really?
Yeah, I hadn't seen that from him before.
He bitched about the course of the British Open last year, I think. Or no, it was Whistling Straits, where he won the U.S. Open. Was losing, and the mics caught it. Let's see. The cat. I am most intrigued as to what Delaware sporting events you attended.
Mud Hens?
Is it the Blue Hens? Blue Hens.
Let's not make fun of a fine 1AA football program.
Joe Flacco.
Fighting Blue Hens.
Wasn't making fun of it. He was asking what sporting events.
Well, you call them the
Mud Hens. It was Toledo Mud Hens.
Yeah. This is the University of Delaware fighting Blue
Hens. Blue Hens.
There were a number of big all-star games for the top high school athletes that I was part of the broadcast and interviewed.
Didn't Delaware steal Michigan's helmets and paint them blue?
You also get them. Well, they didn't steal them because they had some sort of connection back in the day with that football program. One was a national powerhouse. The other was a small-time college program. So maybe it's an homage. I didn't know we were going to be attacking the universe. Next, you're going to say something bad about Tubby Raymond. And if that happens, I'm going to punch you right in the eye.
Well, I don't know that he was as good a coach as what
one of the greats.
Else thinks.
One of the greats.
Why'd they call him Tubby?
I don't know. I haven't been there in a while, and that knowledge has fallen out.
He wasn't especially large, was he?
No, he was actually a little fiery guy.
Yeah.
Doug, didn't the Tottenham Hotspurs win the SC Cup last year? They got a great result against Newcastle. Thanks, Dogtown Asteroid. Mm. guys, who let this broad out of the kitchen and allowed her to have all these free-thinking ideas? Thanks. That's from Grandpa Pigeon.
Well, it wasn't her ideas the kind that you could get behind? If that was a political candidate talking like that, wouldn't you say, boy, she sure makes a lot of sense?
Yes. I watched the interview. The interview I watched, you can watch it on YouTube if you want. Again, my reasoning for being fascinated, and I understand she's attractive, so people are like, oh, you're into it because she's attractive. Stacey Dash is crazy beautiful. God, one of my all-time favorites, actually. But, you know, I mean, this interview was more my style, so to speak, than yesterday's. But I truly find it to be, for lack of a better term, a paradox to have somebody who is outspoken, I don't think would be necessarily the case, because I wouldn't describe Essie Cupp as outspoken on it, but she describes herself as an atheist. I'm sure there are many other people who would, or at the very least agnostic, but they know it's not popular, and so therefore just keep it to themselves, which is completely cool. But to be a conservative commentator, an outspoken, or at the very least discusses, as I said, her atheism, but then be so, fascinated by religion to the point that she would pursue a master's in it at NYU, and then B, be very defensive or on the offense against those who attack religious people. And that's unique, as I said. And she said, well, if it is, that's a shame. And whether or not one would deem it a shame, I would consider it to be, at the very least, unique. And therefore, that's why I wanted to get an understanding from where she was coming from. And so the fact that she's able to state her reasoning, and that's where I am as well. I can't connect those dots. That doesn't mean, though, that if somebody is a Christian, Jew, Muslim, Hindu, whatever you want to name, that I, oh, screw you, you're an idiot. You have a view, you disagree, God bless America. That's it. There's not a whole lot to it. I'm not going to ever advocate infringing on somebody's right to practice their faith. But at the same time, I would appreciate it for those who are religious. Let me be me as well. And that's where I feel like there is a disconnect. And that's why I'm such an advocate of civil discourse. And at the very least, sitting down or having a conversation or an understanding and go, okay, well, we're just going to disagree. And you believe this and I don't, or I believe this and you don't. Doesn't affect my life. You know, you can live your morals as you like, but please keep them out of the law. And that's that.
I think a lot of people that are religious don't try to shove it down someone else's throat, a lot of them, and have that same approach. They don't hate people that are non-believers, but I do think, like everything else, the extremes of one side or the other are the loudest, so people associate anyone in that group with that.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Don't you have friends that are very religious and it's not something that comes up every second and they're not telling you how to live? You know,
that's pretty rare, actually, when somebody does.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that.
Well,
so, no hate.
10% of the country would vote for an atheist president. So it's something that's a factor.
She even brings up, you know, that, you know, at its best, religion, even if you disagree with some of the smaller points, at its best, I'm talking about religion is a good roadmap for, you know, living a good moral life. It can be. But I think, again, once you get to the extremes, then it goes off the road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. If people find peace in it, if it gives them a purpose, if it leads them to lead a better, you know, a more moral life, and they like themselves better, then it's done its part.
Guys, I like Doug's morality all over my chest.
Who? I think I know.
Stubby applause.
Seems like someone's going to get registered for a prize.
Stubby, Stubby applause. You've been suspended. You've been suspended a period of 2 days' time. Your name is going to the Llewellyn's Pub suspension logule. And unfortunately, from my point of view, just by being suspended, you now have a chance to win a trip to spring training. I don't know how that worked out, but yet that's how it is.
Sounds like you hate the sales staff.
Well, I thought they were maybe a little desperate on this one. Llewellyn's Summer Sweeps is in full swing. Now through Labor Day, you go into any Llewellyn's six locations, order the special of the day. You'll have a chance to win a trip to spring training along with 11 other amazing prizes. Second place is a trip to Louisville for a distillery tour. Third prize, VIP tour of Anheuser-Busch for 25 guests. You just go to Llewellyn's and you order the special of the day. Today it's Irish mussels, 1 pound of blue mussels steamed in garlic, Jameson and butter, tossed with tomatoes, capers, and onions, served with herbed focaccia toast.
That's Tim's new nickname, focaccia. Irish mussels.
Never heard of that toast.
I like that. We got a break. Tease Farms, 9 o'clock hour next. Ryan Kelly, Morning After.